So I was going to say that, you know, I was thinking about people who've influenced me. The person who's really most influenced me directly is Mimi Calvati, my mentor. I've dedicated the book to her. You know, she's influenced me as a poet, but particularly she's influenced me directly as a teacher. I won her. in fact, I won her twice. I can't speak highly enough of her, both as a poet and as a teacher. I've learned so much from her, you know, so I did want to mention that. Really, I wouldn't have this book if it wasn't for me. And it's a shame because I dedicated to it, but it's rather lost because the book got a bit crowded at the end, so it's not obviously clear. So I try and mention it every time I read it. I'll dedicate the next one to it as well to try and make sure it's a bit clear. So what I'll do is I'll just read, because I've said quite a lot already, I can just sort of read some, but I'll also say a few comments in between, just partly just gives you a rest. Otherwise it's just too hard listening to poems. W.H. Auden's definition of poetry is memorable speech, which I think you couldn't get much of a better definition. So it's worth, when you think about poetry, that's what we're talking about, is memorable speech. And if you think of it like that, it's much less problematic. The word poetry has become a bit problematic. What you're trying to do is write memorable speech. So I'll read the dedicatory poem. Seems to be I rather like writing dedicatory poems. I've got one for the next collection already. It's called This. There's no law against my listening to this thrush behind the barn. The song so loud it echoes like a bell that it's further off beyond the lawn. Whatever else there is, there's this as well. There's no law against this singing, nesting, I suppose, up in the silver birch, even though we build a common hell, have done, and will make it worse. Whatever else there is, there's this as well. So that sort of is my dedication to the collection. It's many things, but one of the things it is, it's a sort of my cry against miserabilism. Whatever else there is, there's this as well. There are the terrible things, even though we build a common hell, have done, and we'll make it worse, that's true. But there is still the song of a thrush. That one doesn't cancel the other out. It also, I think, I didn't realise this when I wrote it, but I think it possibly is trying to say, actually there's still value in writing about nature. It's interesting, I've lived in London now most of my life, but I'm nothing like an urban poet. I don't write urban poetry, I just don't seem to have it. I've written one or two, but hardly any, and they don't seem to ever get in the collections. Don't seem to have it in me. This poem is is actually a meditation. It came out of a meditation, but then was written as in the voice of a child, so it looks like a biographical poem. And of course, when you write in the voice of a child, your biography comes into it, if you see what I mean. So it's sort of both. It was influenced because I'm now, I've got two little children in my life. My partner Gary, he's got two girls, a 7-year-old and a 6-year-old, and I'm not a daddy, but I'm much closer to that than I ever have been. In fact, recently someone was saying to Alex, the eldest, if you go to New Zealand, won't you miss your daddies? And she said, I've only got one daddy. And this friend said, what about Maitreya Bandhu? He said, Maitreya Bandhu is just a person. Which I thought was perfect. You know, whatever we do, we should just all remember that we're just a person. Anyway, I was watching, going on a bear hunt with her many times, so I don't know whether you've ever seen it, it's a children's thing that has this particular structure, and we'd watch it, and then we'd get to the end, and which is when she's about 3, I suppose, she'd just say, again. And then we'd watch it again, watch it all the way through, again. Which is watch it. And somehow the structure of going on a bear hunt is actually part of the poem, where you have probably noticed it. It's a typical sort of nursery rhyme structure where you say A, B, C, D, E, and then E, D, you know, and then you go backwards. It's got that kind of structure. called The Small Boy and the Mouse. So it's like a Jack and Nori thing. It's a children's story. The Small Boy and the Mouse. When he closed his eyes and asked the question, he saw an egg, a boiled egg, lodged above his heart. The shell had been broken off with a teaspoon, he supposed. It was pure curd white and still warm. Inside, he could see inside, there was a garden with rows of potatoes, sweet peas in a tangle, and a few tomatoes, red and green ones, along with that funny sulphur smell coming from split sacks. There was an enamel bathtub in the garden with chipped edges, a brown puddle staining around itself, and a few wet leaves. He could see down the plug hole, so the sun must have shone, and he heard his father digging potatoes, knocking off the soil, and his mother fetching the washing in, because the sky promised a shower. There was a hole, or rather a pipe, under the tub where the water went, and down at the bottom was a mouse. Its ribs were poking out, its damp fur clung together. The mouse was holding a black and white photograph of a boy who might have been 3 or 4 years old. He was playing with boxes, or were they saucepans from the kitchen? He was leaning forward and slightly blurred. And what was strange about the picture, apart from being held by a mouse who sat on his haunches and gripped it in his forepaws, was that the space around the boy, the paleness around him, expanded, got very bright, and engulfed the mouse, the bathtub, the garden, and the egg with its shell cracked off. After that, there was nothing, apart from the dark inside the boy's head and a kind of quiet he'd never had before. He opened his eyes. All the furniture looked strange, as if someone had rearranged it. And that's how it is, isn't it? After you meditate, all the furniture looks strange, as if someone had rearranged it. So there are, you know, in the collection, sort of explicitly biographical poems. Poems about my mother, but particularly poems about my father. I won't read one of those tonight. My father died many years ago, but it's sort of a continual presence in the poems, particularly his sort of ethical nature, I think. But this is a poem about my mother. Poor old mother. I don't quite know what she felt when she read it, but there you go. Called The Chest of Drawers. And actually it's about my grandmother and my mother. It's a sort of poem about the female line in my family. The Chest of Drawers. I ran along the lilac path to go and see her in the darkened room where, dressed in black, she sat with two Alsatians at her feet. She showed me how to dust between the rungs of a wooden chair. You held the duster at either end, then pulled one end, then the other. She taught me how to draw a swan without lifting the crayon off my pad, a triple loop that finished with the head and beak, and once I coloured in a goose bright yellow without going over the lines. She was so pleased, she told my mother I was sure to be all right. I'd follow my mother around the house and watch her dust and shine. She had let me hold the polished tin while she ironed my older brother's shirts or hoovered up the lounge. She'd roll our socks inside each other and press them into drawers. I'd watch her make the beds. She'd tuck the sheets and blankets in so tight you had to wriggle when you got in to make a proper space. I'd ask her what to dream about. She'd say, the dog, or sailing out to sea. Anything to keep away the nightmares I would have about a man locked inside an iron mask. So I did. I had these ongoing nightmares about a man locked inside a man in Mars. There was a film called, wasn't there, called The Man in the Iron Mask. There'd also been a murder in the town about that time, and somehow the two things had gone together. The photo kit picture of the murderer you know, the, have you seen this man? And this field, the man in the iron mask. So I thought I'd read a section or two from Rangiatea. Rangiatea is a Maori word. I don't need to tell you what it means because it says so in the poem. And the interesting thing about this poem, it's a poem in four sections. It's the longest single poem in the collection. It's the most difficult poem I've ever written to date, apart from these huge long narratives which are still in parts on the garage floor, as it were. And it all came from one of those very rare things for me where the first sentence appears fully formed in my mind. So I was in New Zealand. I was staying in a house on the beach looking over to an island called Rangiatea. No, it wasn't called Kapiti. And when I'd arrived the day before, it was very bright sunshine and there was this beautiful island. Then in the morning I woke up and it was misty. And as soon as I looked out the window, I had this sentence, the sea was grey, but the island was missing. The sea was grey, but the island was missing. Completely, and I knew immediately, oh, that's the first line in a poem. And then it spent 95 drafts and 3 years trying to work out what that poem is. And it really is like that. I think the poet Valerie, how do you pronounce his name? Do you know?
Sure.
I'm never quite sure. Valerie, the French poet. He said that poetry is a bit like you find an exotic piece of fruit on the floor, and the rest of the poem is trying to build the tree that fruit came from, if you see what I mean. Very good metaphor for it. So that first line was like, oh crumbs, that's a poem, and I have to find out what that poem is. And first of all, it was 16 lines, and then it was a whole section, and then it was two sections, and then it was three sections, and then it was four sections. And it was all just to work out the meaning of that line. And of course, really, the meaning of that line is in one word, isn't it? So it's, the sea was grey, but the island was missing. If it was the sea was grey and the island was missing, there'd be no poem. It all comes from that word, but. Why did I say but? And the whole poem is about that problem of but. Sea was grey, but the island was missing. So what does that mean? Does it mean immediately that but creates the whole poem? Or it could have done, but it just took ages to unravel it. So if you've got patience, I'll read you the first two sections. It's four sections long. And I think of it as a fully metaphysical poem, but written in not a domestic register, that's not quite right, but in a reduced register. My register in poetry generally is reduced, as we were saying, so an understated register. It's a poem of the fall, really. Rangiatea. The sea was grey, but the island was missing. Irregular in the half haze, like the haunches of a dog, the island was battleship grey and heading south. The dead had stopped before their journey across the waves. A cormorant, standing on a rock, looked like the phoenix on a family crest. Terns snatched fish from the skipping sea. Groups of seagulls gathered along its shore, and light touched pebbles in the muffling bays. The sun rose on gorse bushes and birds. It rose on broken shells and on the sea, where the clouds had shone. It rose above wooded peaks, making curtained shadows on the flanks of hills. It rose, and then it set, turning the trees bright red. At night, a full moon created an isle of frost and a phosphorescent sea. Then it became a shape of night in the centre of night, with just a few stars hung above it. No boats made the journey, no fishermen with nets, no guns, harpoons, no invaders or men with measuring sticks. Every day was like the last. Curlews fretted among the tides. Crabs lived quietly under stones. Fish were moving patterns in the sea. Beyond the northern ridge, a white whale sang. It was the place out there, Rangiatea, as the Maori say, somewhere you could stay and find the peace you wanted, somewhere you could watch the blue deepening and deepening, hear the gulls cry and the breakers breaking, somewhere you could sit and think the whole thing over. But now the island was missing. No one remembered the island except a man, a bachelor who looked after his mother till she died. He often dreamt about it, curving bays and birds, 4 miles out and hidden, half hidden in the cloud. He couldn't decide if the island was real or just the interval between sleeping and waking, known only from the corner of your eye, a star you couldn't see head on, a seal above the rolling waves and watching. He thought he remembered the journey out, his mother worried by the boat, his father impatient to arrive. But the memory was blurred, like a story he'd been told, or just another beach he went to as a child. Had they let him play there on his own? The tiny break of shells under his sandals' feet, the quiet stretching so far, he heard a wave turning out at sea. There were seagulls on the mirrored sand, his mother asking for him, but not recognising him, her frightened look whenever he turned her over to rub her back, the struggle with her nightdress, her grip so tight he had to peel away her hand, how ridged and reddened her skin was from where the sheets had gathered up. The nurse came twice a day, once to put her in a chair and once to lift her out. All the other visitors had stopped. He'd grown tired of sympathetic words. But the day she died, everything rang out, quietly, quietly, with a kind of sense, a pattern he could touch. He thought the answer, if there was one, must be simple, like looking slightly to the left. So those are the first two sections. And you see in that second section, it's the first time I tried to do a jump cut. So you go from the whole question is, does the island exist or not? Is it real? Is it a memory? Is it a story? Does it have a collective reality? And then that goes into it somehow being mixed up with the mother. The ridges on her skin are like the ridges in the sand. The day she died, everything rang out quietly, quietly, with a kind of sense, a pattern you could touch. And it did strike me that the answer, if there is one, must be simple, like looking slightly to the left. So you see, it's a metaphysical poem written down into the sort of register, and then the fall of the poem continues. I won't read it all, it's a bit too long to read it. Okay, I thought I'd read a confessional one. I've never read this in reading it. Sometimes quite nice to read things I haven't read before. Partly you get a sense to see, it's like road testing them, see whether they work out loud. See where they work as memorable speech. So this was written on a retreat, as most of my poems were. I started at least. My mentor says if it takes a day to write a poem, it takes a week to find the form. And that's just about right. It's the form that's difficult. And form has to be an expression of content. So you have to find out what form the poem wants to be in. Is it in stanzas? Is it in meter? Increasingly I write in pentameter, mostly. For instance, that poem about my mother, that's in pentameter, in, you know, di-dum, 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 di-dum. Once you start writing in pentameter, it gives a certain rhythm to work. This is in free verse. Anyway, it's more confessional. About as confessional as it gets in the book. It's called Sierra Aitana, which is the range of mountains around Kukuloka. And I was on solitary there at the time. And I would imagine you'll recognise the sentiment. Sierra Aitana. This housefly buzzing in frenzied circles. This lizard fast across a stone. This injured forager ant half mad with pain. This bird among the branches, constantly glancing up, like a foreigner dining alone in a strange hotel. And me sitting in the sun, a narrow text of rancour running through my heart. Very simple, very short. And there is a few little love poems. There's some poems in on Suzanne, a poem called Letters to Suzanne. There's three poems on Suzanne. I won't read them, but Suzanne is a great sort of hero of mine. On my recent solitude, I wrote poem after poem about Suzanne. So I imagine, I'm hoping one day, if I live long enough, I'll end up with a collection of poems just about Suzanne. There'll be, you know, a whole autobiographical book, and not a biographical book on Suzanne, with poems, hopefully. I'm still working on them now. They're mostly in note form. So that hopefully will come one day. So this is another poem about painting, about Braque in this case. But it's a rather cheeky love poem. It's as close as I get to a love poem. Except the person I was thinking of when he read it didn't. He said, that's a poem about painting. I thought, that's just as well that you think that. When I got back from my time away, it was Poem of the Week of The Guardian, which was something of a surprise. I think they probably like love poems. It's called Putting Away Pictures, and it is the story I tell of Braque is true. Putting away pictures. When a painting lost its lustre, it improved, Braque said, if you put it in the sun to warm the madder browns and umbers. People laughed at that. But paintings do improve if you put them in a drawer or, like reprimanded children, turn them to face the wall. No one rearranges the forms, adjusts the faulty profile of a tree, the figure out of kilter with the ground. No one modulates the colour key, takes it down a pitch or two. Shadows on the wall are all that's needed to make amends. The same could be said of you. It's all in the last line. But there was one of those poems where it looks like it's all about thing, but it's actually about you know, relationships, that sometimes a gap is the best thing. I think I'll read it again because I haven't read it before. When a painting lost its lustre, it improved, Braque said, if you put it in the sun to warm the madder browns and umbers. People laughed at that. But paintings do improve if you put them in a drawer or, like reprimanded children, turn them to face the wall. No one rearranges the forms, adjusts the faulty profile of a tree, the figure out of kilter with the ground. No one modulates the colour key, takes it down a pitch or two. Shadows in the wall are all that's needed to make amends. The same could be said of you. Okay, so I'll read... some of the poems from the Stephen sequence, and then I'll finish, see how much time we've got, and then I'll finish with Visitation. And I'll be finished in time for you. So what I'll just read these end on end, if you just mean, because you've heard about the story already, I don't need to. And they are a sequence, so they sort of go on from each other a bit. The cutting. The cutting at the end of Crockett's Lane had a meadow on either side, a brow fringed with blackthorn, and a few sheep grazing in sodden fields below. It carried steam trains up to Lapworth before the beaching axe cut the branch lines down. Now it was a brambled V overrun with elderflowers and buddleia. We'd go there blackberrying, filling colanders and plastic tubs. The cutting was a good walk from the house, almost far enough to tire the dogs. I remember children on the embankment carrying Union Jacks up against the sky like little soldiers. They came from all the local schools because we'd heard the Queen would visit Henley in the royal train. But that can't be right. That line came up before I was even born, and only Dad remembered steam trains huffing up and down it. I took Stephen there one summer. We kicked up dandelions and it was hot. We got those sticky burrs stuck to our shorts and socks.
We were looking for somewhere we'd be safe and out of sight, a cleft beside a pond. And as we walked, two pigeons clattered out. We waded nettles that reached up to our chest. I managed to lift his shirt and touch his side. But he was scared, and so was I, and anyway, the train didn't stop. We just stood there on the platform while she thundered past. The brook. Standing on a bridge in the beginnings of snow, taking the measure of it, the water's reach, trees reflected, the careening white of gulls. I was trying to keep it all, the river's elbowing, the valley's palm. He was standing on a bridge and couldn't speak, water racing over pebbles and half bricks, a sound like muted ovation, like an audience constantly rising to its feet. I was looking to where the silted leaves might show a trout or stickleback, a sluggish weight of water. He was waiting by the dam beside the brook. The mop. The mop came once a year and blocked the high street. The route past Station Road became a web of cables, spools and drums, with wires snaking across the road or slung from stall to stall. Gypsies in high-sided lorries with mongrels on their laps, when boys with sullen eyes spend most of the day erecting the ghost train in the coconut shy. Goldfish hung in plastic bags between the flashing lights. They'd swell up and then go back to normal size. By evening, ropes of coloured lights hung between the lawns. Sylvester filled the air, along with candy floss and diesel fumes. Cars flung you back and forth, and waltzers span you round while you held the bar and screamed. A man would walk the rising, falling floor like he was striding across the sea, although he nearly always chose the girls. Yellow plastic ducks swam together in a revolving circle backed by mirror glass. Each one had a wire hoop under its bill, so if you managed to hook one out, a gypsy would read the number felt-tipped on the base, then pass across a pair of Spanish dancers or a plaster of Paris fish, flat and white and chalky from behind. I never played the one-armed bandits, but I liked the fruit, spinning lemons, strawberries and pears, the handle pull, the regurgitated money. Stephen was standing with a group of friends, just inside the tent. I kept my eyes averted, although something must have ached. He turned away, but didn't join the taunts. That must have been the year I said I'd take my Nana to the mop, but when Penny came, or Pauline, I forgot, and she sat all evening waiting in the house. I think I see him standing by the Dodgem steps, hands inside his pockets, his face flashing amber, red and green. The girls were getting off, feeling wobbly and having to sit down, while a man would run across and help each time too many cars collided. The mop had gone by morning. The streets were quiet again and dull. They'd even swept and cleared away the litter. It was around the start of autumn. The air had that sudden softness. Leaves were turning. He'd been waiting to do something with his life when someone screamed as a woman we both knew turned right and knocked him off his bike. Wild bees. The railway bridge across the A45, just beyond the High Street, was demolished when I was 10 or so. Workmen in hard hats and acetylene torches cut the iron trusses into slabs and blocked the weekday traffic. I used to walk across it and look down at cars coming in and out of Henley, my father's lorry, a coach returning home. The path to Loddersfield was further on. The dogs squeezed through a stile when I let them. We'd go there on our own, Stephen and I, down a steep and weedy slope, this side of an old footbridge, so hidden in the ground you didn't know you were walking on a bridge. Usually we'd hide inside the arch that once had spanned a mill stream long dried up, strewn with bags and open tins of dog food, where a tramp was said to sleep. But this time we pushed along the ditch to find a hideout near the road, a den we only went to once, where I tried the words, "I loved you," then kissed his tight-shut mouth. We must have disturbed a nest of wild bees and made them mad. I ran away with bees tangled, fizzing in my hair. He watched me go. That was before they turned the desert park into expensive flats, before Haven Pastures became a golf club, before someone burnt the scout hut down. Just three more, I think. Newspapers. My father kept the baled-up newspapers inside the old green lorry. They mouldered in the summer heat. The Page Three girl, Snoopy at the back of the Daily Mail, UFOs and the Mask of Tutankhamun. He kept them for the scouts, along with gold and silver bottle tops. The lorry was near the hedge where I lost my mother's bread knife. My brothers jumped off the lorry roof onto bales of hay, Robert going first. But when it came to my turn, I hit my jaw against my knees and ran down the garden crying. Next door's garden was overgrown with weeds. When the neighbour died, my father said, he left instructions which compost heap his body should be left on. We went there once. Raspberries and red currants were tangled up in briars, and there were runner beans choked with nettles still growing on their sticks. Stephen managed to force the back door open. We climbed the narrow, buckled stair that led up to a box room lined with newspapers left over from where the underlay had been. A single window overlooked the ruined garden. It felt like everyone could see. So he climbed up through the attic hatch until his legs disappeared in the dark. That must have been a year before he was killed at the intersection between Bow Desert Lane and the High Street, his body lying under a blanket on the ground, the ambulance stopping the traffic, and me walking to school the morning of my art exam. The usual things. I should say time didn't hurt you or turn you grey, make you stoop or gasp when you stood up, grow beer-bellied, fat and idle by the television, your youth worn out in marriage or in consequence. I should say that you were saved from the usual shocks, the simple disappointments, the standard cost of error, which anyway would take away your life. Hansel never grew up. The crumb road lost. I should say you were my love, but you were not. You stand in twilight on your father's lawn. No blackbird sings in a small-minded English town. And when I try to touch you, you push me off. And then finally, retrospect. In my story, you walked to school that day, left the moped in the garage with your gauntlets on the seat, caught up with me, suggested we should meet back at your house, your brother still at work. I tell myself we carry on from there, off and on until I move away. Now you're 25 and have learnt the art of smiling. We talk about the time you waited in the bath next to your parents' kitchen after school. But the story won't make sense. The facts you left, too small to be given consequence. I can't put explanations in your mouth. You just stand there in the kitchen doorway, pencil slim and pale, and carrying a helmet. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you.